Okay, we're ready?
You want to increase your font size?
Don't want to do it. Oh, yes, I did. Thank you. I'm going to make it really, really... How's that? Yeah, is that good? Could everyone see in Zoom land?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, good. So
it's a little too much.
A little too... Well, it's too bad. Okay, so good... Let me just make it a little bit lower. Just make the volume a little bit lower. Okay, well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the first in a four-part series on the Book of Koheles. It's actually funny because I wanted to go for the alliteration, which is why I called the class Exploring Ecclesiastes, but it's probably harder to say the English word than the Hebrew word, but you'll forgive me. Anyways, it's a class on Koheles, and today is the first part. And so today is going to be substantially different than the next 3 weeks. The next 3 weeks, what we'll do is we'll actually go through the text itself. But for this week, what I want to do is really just offer a general introduction to the book and try to have an understanding of a few basic questions. The first is, what exactly is the goal of the Book of Koheles? What are we trying to get out of it, right? So every single book of Tanakh is there to teach us something and is there to inform us in one way, shape, or form. And Koheles gets a sort of a reputation as being one of the most depressing of books. And so the question is, what is the ultimate takeaway and goal? That we'll have to see exactly who the author of it was, but what is the goal of the author of the book? That's question number one. Question number two is that we know that the reason why we're learning this topic now is because we'll be reading the Book of Koheles on the holiday of Sukkot. And so the obvious elephant in the room question is, why is it that we read this book on Sukkot when it has nothing to do with the holiday of Sukkot, right? And so the other books, you'll say, at least have tangential relationships with the holidays. So let's take the Book of Yonah that we learned last year. So that we read on Yom Kippur. And Yonah is a book about Teshuvah, and there's a lot of good reasons why that could be relevant to Yom Kippur. And Rus, which is the holiday in which we learn a lot about conversion and joining the Jewish nation, and the holiday of Shavuos that we read it on is the holiday in which we all became part of the Jewish people when we accepted the Torah. And of course, Megillas Esther on Purim is directly correlated to the holiday. But when it comes to Koheles, it seems to have nothing to do with the holiday of Sukkot. And so therefore, our major question that we'll conclude with at the end is trying to understand why we read this book on the holiday of Sukkot. And the last major question, and we'll throw in a few additional ones as we go through the class, but the last major question is, how is it that the rabbis, how is it that Chazal came to understand what the Book of Koheles is really all about? Because, of course, there is likely two different, at least, perspectives that you can take on a book in general. One is what the author's goal was, and number two is what exactly Chazal, what our rabbis meant to take out of it. And sometimes the two line up, and sometimes the two don't necessarily line up. The Book of Shir HaShirim, right, of course, very famously that we read on Pesach, it's very clearly different from the literal explanation of the text and what our rabbis tell us the text is all about. And so where does Koheles sort of fall in that spectrum? Is it meant to be taken literally? If so, how do we grapple with the depression level news that the author shares with us? And so with that, as a general introduction, we will begin. So if you take a look at source number one that I have here, I apologize if it's too big and I apologize if it's too small. What I have for you is just the basic English translation of the middle of the first parak, the middle of the first chapter, going to towards the end of the second parak. And I'm going to read this, sort of skim through it together. And what I'd like you to do as we're reading it is take a note of a few different elements that seem to be recurring themes of what we're going to read, and then we'll see if anyone actually catches it at the end. So let's take a look inside. I, Koheles, was king in Jerusalem over Israel. I set my mind to study and to probe with wisdom all that happens under the sun, an unhappy business that which God gave men to be concerned with. I observed all the happenings beneath the sun, and I found that all is futile in pursuit of wind, a twisted thing that cannot be made straight, a lack that cannot be made good. I said to myself, Here I have grown richer and wiser than any that ruled before me over Jerusalem, and my mind has zealously absorbed wisdom and learning. And so I set my mind to appraise wisdom and to appraise madness and folly, and I learned that this too was pursuit of wind. For as wisdom grows, vexation grows. To increase learning is to increase heartache. I said to myself, come, I will treat you to merriment. Taste mirth, that too I found was futile. Of revelry I said, it's mad, of merriment, what good is that? I ventured to tempt my flesh with wine and to grasp folly while letting my mind direct with wisdom. To the end, okay, etc., etc. I multiplied my possessions. I built myself houses and I planted vineyards. I laid out gardens and groves in which I planted every kind of tree. I constructed pools of water. I bought male and female slaves. I also acquired more cattle. I further amassed silver and gold and treasures of kings and provinces. And I got myself male and female singers. And I gained more wealth than anyone before me in Jerusalem, etc., etc., etc. What is the most glaring reality that we'll have to face when we look at this text? What do you see that keeps coming up over and over again?
I.
Right? So why is it that Kohelet seems to be so obsessed with himself? And what, if any, is the takeaway of the fact that he says I more than any other book of Tanakh? The word I keeps coming up over and over and over again. And I want to share with you a beautiful piece that Rabbi Jonathan Sacks writes in this regard. And he says as follows in source number 2. There is no other book in the Bible that uses the word I so many times, as so those first chapters of Ecclesiastes. Kohelet's problem was that he kept thinking about himself. It made him rich, powerful, and a great success. As for happiness, though, he did not have a chance. Happiness lives in the realm called not I. Someone had written to the Rebbe in a state of deep depression, right? So the Lubavitcher Rebbe, someone wrote a letter to him. The letter went something like this. I would like the Rebbe's help. I wake up each day sad and apprehensive. I can't concentrate. I find it hard to pray. I keep the commandments. But I find no spiritual satisfaction. I go to synagogue, but I feel alone. I begin to wonder what life is about, and I need help. The Rebbe wrote a brilliant reply that did not use a single word. All he did was this. He circled the first word of every sentence and sent the letter back. The disciple understood. The Rebbe had answered his question and set him on the path to recovery. The ringed word was I. It is hard to translate a biblical text into contemporary English and still preserve the nuances of the original. But Kohelet's problem was the same as that of the letter writer above. I built for myself, I planted for myself, I acquired for myself. In Hebrew, the insistence on the first person singular is striking, reiterated, and discordant. So what we see immediately at the outset when we begin going into the text of Kohelet is how he speaks in a first person more than anyone else when they wrote their books of Tanakh. And strikingly, we're meant to have some sort of a takeaway from this. And there are two ways that we can view this, right? On the one hand, you can say that maybe Kohelet was very self-obsessed and very, you know, very into himself, and that's why he used the word I a lot. Or, what else might you say?
He's projecting it onto the
readers. What'd you say again, Jim? Okay, good, right? And Bob would just...
I'm saying basically the same thing. It's a reflection of us.
Right, okay, good.
Sometimes when we get lost in the I.
Right, okay, good. So you can say, again, that Kohelet is self-obsessed, or you can say that he's trying to make a point. When you read through this book, how many people will look at this and say, yeah, you know, I did that too. Wait a second. Why am I always talking about I and me? And perhaps what Kohelet is trying to bring out of this is that we have to stop being so I-focused and so me-focused. And it's specifically someone who is like this, who is only focused on themselves, that will be able to achieve perhaps lots of individual and personal successes in the gashmius realm, in the physical realm. But as far as deep existential happiness and having and finding meaning in life, that is going to be very difficult if you're always focused on I. And it's specifically for reasons and things like this that Chazal struggled with the book of Kohelet so much. because when it came to a few different texts that we have in our tradition, Chazal very, very much so did not understand, at least at first glance, what the place of a specific text might have been in the canon of the entirety of Tanakh. But for the most part, Chazal accept every single book that we see as part of Tanakh to be a part of Tanakh. What is one example that at first there was a Hava Amina, there was an original assumption that maybe it wasn't a good book, but then ultimately they said, no, it was a good book? Shir HaShirim, right? Song of Songs, right? So the book that, of course, if you translate the text very literally, it's very graphic and it's not very appropriate for a PG audience. But no, if you come to understand and recognize that there is a greater depth there, then the text is actually quite beautiful because it talks about the relationship between the Jewish people and Hashem. And that is incredible that we have such a deep, intimate relationship with the Almighty. And you have to learn how to translate the text in a different fashion. However, when it comes to the book of Koheles, Chazal question its addition into the canon of Tanakh, and although they ultimately accept that it is part of Tanakh, they seem to ultimately really struggle with the fact that it was left in there. Let's take a look inside in source number 3. It's the Mishnah and Maseches Yadayim that has this conversation. Again, some of this is going to feel familiar because most people quote it in reference to Shir HaShirim, but we're going to be looking at it in reference to Koheles. All the holy scriptures defile the hands. Right, so this is an important fun fact that we have to be aware of and understand before we go any further, and that is that if you are going to consider something to be part of the holy scriptures, that means that it is going to, by definition, according to a rabbinic decree, make the hands not pure, impure when you touch them. And so therefore, the code that we have to be able to decipher is that if something does defile the hands, then by definition it is
holy.
A holy book. If it does not defile the hands, then not so holy. So let's take a look. The Song of Songs and Koheles defile the hands. Rabbi Yehuda says the Song of Songs defiles the hands, but there is a dispute about Koheles. Rabbi Yossi says Kohelet does not defile the hands, meaning it's not considered a holy work. But there is a dispute about the Song of Songs. Rabbi Shimon says the ruling about Kohelet is one of the leniencies of Beit Shammai and one of the stringencies of Beit Hillel. And Rabbi Shimon ben Azai said, I have received a tradition from the 72 elders on the day when they appointed Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah head of the academy, that the Song of Songs and Koheles defile the hands. And Rabbi Akiva said, no man in Israel ever disputed that the Song of Songs, saying that it does not defile the hands. So Rabbi Akiva comes to a very important defense of Shir HaShirim. He says, no one ever thought for a second that Shir HaShirim was not a beautiful text. It's true, you have to understand it on a deeper level than the basic pshat, than the basic black and white understanding of the words, but no one ever questioned for a second how great Shir HaShirim was. For the whole world is not as worthy as the day on which the Song of Songs was given to Israel. For all the writing's famous words are holy, but the Song of Songs is the holy of holies. Right? So according to Rabbi Akiva, he shuts everyone up. Forgive me for speaking so bluntly. He says, enough of this. Shir HaShirim is a holy text, undisputed. Not only is it holy, but it is the holiest of all books of Tanakh. If they had a dispute, they had a dispute only about Kohelet. That was the big question, and that was what Chazal had to struggle with. Ultimately, they decided and came to a conclusion that it does metame the hands, that it does make hands impure, and therefore Koheles is a holy text. But the fact of the matter is, the conclusion of this is the most important that we have to, or rather not the conclusion, but the conversation is the most important, that there really are those who existentially struggled with this book, so much so that even though ultimately they all accepted that it's part of the biblical canon, that it's part of Tanakh as we know it, nonetheless, there were many rabbis who said, I don't understand how this could be. Meaning, what those rabbis who struggled with it are saying is that they understand that there are texts of Tanakh that are meant to not be taken black and white literally, that there is meant to be a more allegorical interpretation over here. And even from that mentality, they still look at Koheles and say, this is such a pointless book because it's so futile and it's so, ooh, Mazel tov, mazel tov. It's so futile and it's so vain, and it talks so deeply about these struggles that really only a self-centered type of individual might have, and it seems to be irrelevant for us. So again, to be very clear, it is part of our canon, it is part of Tanakh, but there are many in Chazal who struggled with this. So what was so bad about Koheles to begin with? So if you take a look in source number 4, there's a Gemara in Shabbos that begins to sort of dig a little deeper into the struggles that Chazal had with the book. Since contradictions in Koheles were mentioned, the Gemara cites additional relevant sources. So Rav Yehuda, son of Rav Shmuel bar Shelat, said in the name of Rav, that the Chachamim sought to suppress the book. This is another good example where the English is not as good as the Hebrew. They sought to not just suppress it, they sought to bury it. They wanted to put it into Geniza. They wanted to put it into Shemos and never see it again, right? We have a big Shemos room that no one walks into here, and no one will ever walk into again, unless you're bringing more Shemos, and no one ever looks at the Shemos room. And so that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to put the book away, lock it up, throw away the key, and never would it be seen ever again. That's what Chazal wanted to do with it. Why? Because its statements contradict each other, and it's liable to confuse its readers, right? So this is important. Chazal took one look at Koheles, and they said, here is this guy, again, we'll see who this guy is, many of us have an assumption of who he is, we'll see how true that might be according to Chazal, but we see this individual named Koheles, who by that name alone, we have no idea who he was historically, but we know he was this big king, a very special king over Jerusalem, and he writes lots of really difficult, theologically concerning things. He talks about how everything is vain and everything is worthless, and he does, as we'll see in a moment, towards the end, say something positive about serving God, but by and large, he says most of life is just pointless. Chazal don't need to have that kind of messaging out there, that here's what the rabbis think. The rabbis think that it's stupid to be alive. That does not, you know, have a very good PR messaging for the Jewish religion. And so therefore, they said, let's get rid of it. Why did they not suppress it? Why did they not put it into Geniza, into Shemos? Because its beginning consists of matters of Torah, and its end consists of matters of Torah, right? Which is a striking statement. In other words, the whole book, what the Gemara is saying, if we understand this more deeply, what's the Gemara saying over here? The beginning is great and the end is great. What about the middle? Not very great. Chazal are saying, we from like verse 3 in the first parak until like the third to last pasuk in the last parak, we basically hate everything in between. But Pasuk 1 is so good, and the last Pasuk is so good, that we'll just keep all the rest of it. Right? So it's really nice of them not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but this is probably a good time where Chazal should have just thrown the baby out with the bathwater, because you have two good psukim and a few hundred that are terrible. It's unbelievable. But that's what they said. No, the beginning is good, the end is good, and we worry about the middle a little bit later, and even though it does not seem to be in line with how we want to project a worldview onto our nation. Okay. The ostensibly contradictory details are secondary to the essence of the book, which is Torah. The Gemara elaborates, its beginning consists of matters of Torah, as it is written, what profit has man of all his labor which he labors under the sun? And the sages of the school of Rabbi Yannai said, by inference, under the sun is where man has no profit from his labor. However, before the sun, meaning when engaged in the study of Torah, which preceded the sun, he does have profit. Right, so this gets even better. The end of the book of Koheles, as we'll learn a little bit more deeply in the coming weeks, explicitly says that it's good to serve God, it's good to do mitzvos, it's good to learn Torah. The opening of the book of Koheles doesn't even have anything explicitly positive, but Chazal said, okay, we got to figure something out here. All right, that first pasuk, it kind of sounds like you can make up a Torah a drasha from this, and so we're going to say, oh, this whole thing about the sun, it means that Torah is really good. And so, again, forgive me, Chazal didn't make anything up, but it seems like they're scratching their heads and trying to figure out what, if any, benefit there is to the book of Koheles, and they are really, really struggling with it. And then, of course, at the end of the book, we know, the end of the matter, all having been heard, fear God and keep his mitzvah, for this is the whole of man. That's the conclusion of the book of Koheles, and that is very explicitly beautiful. With regard to this verse, the Gemara asks, What is the meaning of the phrase, for this is the whole man? Rabbi Eliezer said, the entire world was only created for this person. Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana said, this person is equivalent to the entire world. And Shimon ben Azai says, and some say that Shimon ben Zoma says, that the entire world was only created as companion to this man so that he will not be alone. So amazingly, says the Gemara, that this concluding pasuk is the only explicit pasuk that we approve of, and more or less, this pasuk is what the entire book of Koheles stands on, and why it has legitimacy in the canon of Tanakh. And amazingly, that's likely why the custom became to repeat the pasuk. Right, the person leaning, he'll say the last pasuk, and then everyone else will say the pasuk after him, because it's almost as if we're saying to ourselves, both implicitly and explicitly, forget about everything else you just heard. That was whatever. Just, hopefully you closed your ears. But the last pasuk, that's the good one. So let's hold on to that one. And that's what Chazal seem to be saying, which again is very troubling, that they should be saying that the whole book is Narishkeit, and just this one verse, two verses, that's the ones that we're shooting for over here. Anyone bothered by that? No? No one's bothered by that? Everyone likes that? Say it again, Jim. Okay, or why is that a problem? Right, it's craziness. I always like to think of the Book of Koheles as, you think of like this supreme genius, which again, as we all know, the elephant in the room, we know that the predominant opinion and the only real opinion out there is that Shlomo HaMelech, that King Solomon is the author of it. And so if King Solomon is truly as smart as he is said to have been, which that is what we believe, so it's almost like you think of a mad scientist, right? You think of like Albert Einstein times a trillion, sitting in his lab, and he just knows everything, and right there are midrashim that talk about how King Solomon could talk to animals, and that he had all these deep insights into the world. And you think it's almost as if a mad scientist has lost it a little bit. Right, wisdom is great, wisdom is terrible, wisdom is amazing. Oh, but you know what, this is great. It sounds like a crazy person is talking. And Chazal don't like that. And so therefore, they say, forget about it. We don't understand what he's saying. But look at the last pasuk. Isn't that a nice last pasuk, everyone? Yeah, everyone repeat the last pasuk. Yeah, that's very nice. And everything else, hush, hush, we don't talk about that. Bob, are you going to say something?
It's like the diary of a bipolar person.
Right, 100%. It seems like you have this individual who is just speaking, who is not totally, what's the opposite of unhinged? Is that... All right. You have someone who's speaking who seems to be unhinged, and the person does not seem to be well, but he said something really smart at the end, and we like that. So again, this... Oh, sorry?
Does Chazal really think the last lines?
Oh, okay, good. So there are those who explain as a possibility that maybe the last line wasn't even written by Shlomo HaMelech, which if that is the case, that's even more confusing. We're reading the book that we don't even like because of the last line, but the author of the book didn't write the last line. And so, okay, we'll have to talk about that. Yeah, Gail, you want to say something?
It's like the experimental method searches. Tries this wealthy thing, tries the dancers, nothing works.
Right.
Then he has to come back and come to a conclusion. Right. Maybe the last line
fit. Right. And it's interesting because the trial and error element of what the author of Koheles is referring to is in and of itself intrinsically terrible, right? You imagine every rabbi gets up there and just tells all the students in yeshiva or whatever, you know what, I'm not sure about this Torah mitzvah thing, go out and try every single avera on the planet, go do everything bad, and you'll make a determination what's good and what's not good. That would not be a very good selling point for that yeshiva, right? Yeah.
He's saying you did it already, so you don't have to.
Right, so but even that, so you're saying one of the greatest Jewish leaders did all these terrible things? Even that itself is an unbelievable statement. But okay, yeah. Go on.
He's talking maybe to himself.
Go on.
Not necessarily to us.
Go on.
He is having great difficulty with the gray of life. Okay? Wisdom is great on the one hand, on the other hand, it's driving me crazy. All of these things are positive, negative, positive, negative. It's all a reflection of his his own brain. His brain is so smart, he sees all the nuances, both good and bad. In contemporary literature, this is Elisha Ben Avuya. Right?
Why?
Just say,
who's Elisha Ben Avuya?
Elisha Ben Avuya was a great rabbi who got sidetracked, so to speak, and went through and decided that he was so brilliant, he got Tanakh, he got all of it. But he said, that's not enough. That doesn't satisfy me. It doesn't answer the question, the gigantic question of why and who am I.
Okay.
That's what this is all about. Why, who am I? And it occurs in Sukkot after we've already done unbelievable inner evaluation of what's important and what's not important. That's why it's in Sukkot.
Okay, good.
But that's what this is all about. This guy, he's not confused. He's really not confused. He's looking at A and B and trying to figure out how do we as human beings negotiate and traverse this life.
Okay, so 100%. Right, so what David is saying over here is that the book of Koheles is the writings and the musings of this absolute genius who was able to see nuances in everything, and he basically just went through it from A to Z, every possible which way that we can view all the positive and all the negative, and the conclusion of his existential angst was the final line of the book of Koheles, which basically says, listen, guys, I learned it all, I did it all, I thought it all. And the conclusion is very clear, that serving God is really the end and the most important thing that a person could be doing. Okay, so 100%. Not everyone will necessarily agree with that perspective. I also don't necessarily agree with the comparison to Elisha Ben Avuya, but we could leave that aside for right now. Thank you, David. Bob always tells me I'm never wrong. Okay. You can tell me why I'm wrong later. Okay, so let's keep going. Amazingly so, there are those who want to go ahead and look back at the rest of the book of Koheles and say, okay, if the last line is all about serving God, learning Torah, doing mitzvahs. Oh, sorry, George. Did you have something you want to say, George?
That's okay. It's similar to what David was saying. I see it.
Would you have said it more respectfully?
I don't know about that, but it doesn't strike me as contradictory as much as it strikes me as a reflection of the human experience of searching for something.
100%.
Reflection, and you don't get to a revelation instantly. You have to go through some things, and those are illustrations of where what he might have thought in this journey might bring him happiness or wisdom, and ultimately each one of those things, whether it was wealth or whether it was giving into the pleasures of the flesh or whatever it might have been, were not the answer. And finally, he arrives after he exhausts all of those avenues, what the real answer is, which is Hashem.
Yeah.
So it's a little. Pretty much what David was saying.
I like how you said it more.
Wasn't serving Hashem the whole time?
Okay, why do you say that?
I mean, his father was David HaMelech.
Okay, good, right?
So, some of his brothers weren't so much, though, I guess.
Okay, so one perspective that you'll hopefully at least consider is that the truth is that the entire time Shlomo HaMelech, or again, whoever this author, whoever this Koheles is, has been serving God since day one, since the very beginning of the text. True, you look at it and it seems a little bit complicated. How could this be considered an Eved Hashem, a servant of God? But the truth is, if we believe that life is all about the ups and downs and the that we don't always get things right, but that part of life is recognizing that it's all about this journey of making mistakes and figuring out what is the right path, then he's probably been serving God the whole time. More than that, there are those who will suggest that if we believe it to be the case that the author of Koheles, that this Koheles individual, believes what he said at the end of the text, and that he still allowed for the entire rest of the text to be there. So it could be that if we looked more deeply at the text of Koheles, and again, on a more darshaning standpoint, to look more deeply and not just the black and white translation, truth be told, we would actually find a similar reality to what we have with Shir HaShirim, right? In Shir HaShirim, we read it literally. It seems like a very inappropriate text. You look at it through the lens of a more deeper exposition, and you find a very deep beauty about the relationship between Hashem and the Jewish people. So too with Koheles. If we're meant to view everything with the lens at the end, which is all about serving God and doing mitzvos, then maybe you could actually look at the entire text and see how the entire time he's been saying with every verse, and one way or another, he's been actually saying the same idea. Doing mitzvot, serving God, learning Torah is all good, and that's what we're supposed to be doing. And if you take a look at source number 5, there's an individual by the name of Moshe Halbertal. He's an interesting scholar, and he has a lot of interesting things to write. And he says as follows: the hedonistic message becomes metaphor. Whenever Ecclesiastes tells you to eat and drink, know that what he means is go and do good deeds and study Torah. The book of Ecclesiastes thus pays dearly for the everlasting fame it wins by being canonized. Renown comes at the expense of distortion and effacement of its unique and radical message, right? So what he's saying here is a very deep idea and part of a larger essay that he writes. But what he's saying is that by the fact that we accept Koheles as part of Tanakh, as part of the larger canon of the Bible that we have, so he says that it must be that every message of the book has to be positive. The notion that only the last pasuk is good but everything else is not great doesn't make any sense, and therefore even if Koheles was saying literally that he tried all these illicit things and ultimately it ended up being not good, and the last thing that he realized was that serving God was the best, in retrospect, if you look at the text, it has to be that he's speaking on a deeper level, that he really meant different types of service of God and doing mitzvos and doing good deeds, because of the fact that no way would we allow a text like this into the canon if we were speaking literally that someone was doing all these horrible illicit things that Kohelet was describing. And so therefore, ultimately we see that the text itself, as far as Chazal were concerned, is a very problematic one in its essence, in its literal translation, and it's this great struggle. And so for the most part, most people would give you the pshat explanation, that is to say that the book is worth it just because of the last pasuk, and everything else, okay, it's a little, we have to struggle with it. However, some will tell you that no, maybe every single verse has that deep message that we have at the end of the book, and so that's what we'll be discussing over the next several weeks, to try to break that down a little bit further and see the rest of the chapters and the entirety of the book, and see if this really is the case, or perhaps if there is a different message there as well. What I want to do over the next few sources is try to understand a few different things. Number one is, can we say unequivocally that Shlomo HaMelech, that King Solomon, is the author of the book of Koheles? That's number one. And number two, to go back to what we raised before, and that is, why is it that we're reading this book on Sukkot? So how do we know that Shlomo HaMelech, how do we know that King Solomon is the author of Koheles?
Word.
Yeah.
And he's the king. He's the richest king. He's father's state. And he's the king who's really in good shape. He's the beginning of his reign.
Okay.
So it would fit.
Okay, so he is a king, he's a rich king, he is a king in Jerusalem, he's the son of King David. So a lot of things fit in nicely. So why doesn't he call himself Shlomo? Why doesn't he call himself by the name that he went by?
I think because he went to meet together all the Kehillah, all the community at the end of Sukkot.
Okay, fantastic, Elisheva. So we'll get to that in a little bit. That the reason why he refers to himself as Koheles is because of his role that he played in Hakel, in gathering the entirety of the Jewish people. We'll get to that in just a moment. But at the end of the day, if he is who we think he is, then you would expect him to at least consider referring to himself by the name. Even more unusual is that if you look at Rashi, of course, the famed commentator on every book of Tanakh and throughout Shas and etc., you'd expect Rashi on the very first line to say, who is Koheles? Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon. What does Rashi say? Not that. He does not actually identify the author of Koheles as being Shlomo HaMelech. He only really says it bluntly in a totally different context. Not at all in the book of Koheles, but rather in Sefer Malachim, the book of Kings of all places. There's a pasuk that says, but in source number 6, Vayidaber Shlosha Salafim Mashal, Vayhi Shiro Chamisha Va'alef, that he, meaning King Solomon, composed 3,000 proverbs and his songs numbered 1,005, so that he said lots of wise, smart things. So Rashi over there in source number 7 says, Vayhi Shiro Chamisha Shlosha Eile, Vashira Shirim Vekoheles. What were all these songs that he was talking about? Well, he lists these different books that he wrote, and one of them is the book of Koheles. If you never saw this Rashi in the book of Malachim, you would not necessarily know that Rashi believed that Koheles was Shlomo HaMelech, which is just fascinating. Again, at the end of the day, Rashi does believe this, and this is the accepted opinion, but it is quite unusual that Rashi would not explicitly say this in the very first pasuk of his commentary on Koheles, and he assumes that you learned and you read what he said in a totally different area of Tanakh. It is quite puzzling. And if you do look in source number 8, we have the very famous Gemara in Bava Basra, in which our rabbis go through all the different authors of the different texts of Tanakh that we have. And it says, interestingly and oddly, Chizkiyahu v'siyato, that it was King Chizkiyah and his merry men, Kasu Yeshaya Mishle Shira Shirim v'Koheles, that it wasn't King Solomon who actually wrote down the book of Koheles, which, by the way, doesn't mean that Shlomo HaMelech didn't author the book, but it means that who wrote it? It was King Chizkiyah, which would be a little bit more compelling and is more compelling for us. Why is this helpful to know that Shlomo HaMelech didn't sit in his room and write down this book, but rather he probably spoke it and then it was written down later? Why would that maybe change how we look at the book a little bit?
May have made some editorial changes.
Who made Chizkiyah?
Chizkiyah.
Okay, good. Maybe Chizkiyah made some editorial changes. Could be. Okay, what else?
You could say one thing today and another thing tomorrow.
Okay, good. Right. So
you're just catching snippets of what you said, somebody writing them down. I
sort of
note cards and put the note cards
into
a box and
right, okay. So one of the main struggles that you might have with this is that Shlomo HaMelech wasn't necessarily saying this to be written down. He was, again, forgive me for saying this a little bit disrespectfully, but he was like pontificating. He was a very wise person. He knew a lot of things, and he was saying, oh, I did this and I did that, and all of a sudden Chizkiyah was listening to him and he decided to write this whole thing down. Who says Shlomo HaMelech wanted to write it down in the first place? Maybe if he would have seen this, he would have been mortified that he was credited with being the author or being the one who came up with a lot of the, again, maybe as Chazal would say, the Narishkeit of the book of Koheles. And so therefore it is worthwhile to note that he is likely not the one who wrote the book down. But I would say even more than that, the fact is when Shlomo HaMelech spoke out this notion of the book of Koheles, who's to say that he wanted this to be for public consumption? Meaning that he believes what he wrote, but to have it canonized in Tanakh, in the Old Testament, that every single person in the world will be able to know that this was written? No, this was maybe for a few of his top students or something like that. That is maybe the most problematic element and the most relevant element for us to take note of, that it wasn't necessarily his intention that everyone would see it. Yeah, George?
It also strikes me as the book that is so focused on I, whose message is so universal. Maybe it was, one could read into it that maybe he consciously, at the end, omitted the I wrote it.
Okay. I hear that point. I might also, if I just want to be the devil's advocate, which I like to be, would say the opposite. It's the fact that he kept saying I all the time that showed that he never meant this for public consumption. If he wanted this to be universal, he probably would have spoken in the we sense, or at least not used the word I so much. He was sitting in bed, I don't know, and he was saying, oh, I did this, I can't believe I did that. Oh man, remember when I was 17, I did that, right? And so he's listed all these things, and he was speaking to himself, which, okay, that's why he said I. Never did he mean necessarily for this to be out there. So again, this potential reality of if he did or didn't mean it is a little bit irrelevant, because the point is that Hashem wanted it to be, right? We believe that if it made it into the canon of Tanakh, then Hashem wanted us to be able to read it. So what his original intentions may or may not have been is a little bit irrelevant at the end of the day, but it certainly is interesting to think about what Shlomo HaMelech had intended when we read this text, and when we see that he was not necessarily, and likely not, the one who actually wrote it down.
No, 100%. I mean, I'll go back to the idea that this is a reflection of all of us. We all try, we all collect, we all have, we all desire, we all, and in the end, Brink's truck doesn't follow the hearse. You know?
I knew what you were saying until that last line.
We have a relationship with Hashem, and that's the most important
thing. Okay, right. So 100%. And as an additional argument that you can make, and then we'll move on, is that most great rabbis and great spiritual leaders in Judaism and every other religion, quite frankly, throughout all time, do not write a public note about all the sins or all the wrongdoings that they may have committed. Right? I'll never forget this. I love telling the story. When I was in yeshiva, in my Shana Aleph, in my first year in yeshiva, so one of my rebbeim, who is a good man, but maybe he shouldn't have done what I'm about to tell you he did, he would sometimes make fun of one of the older rebbeim who always was like bawling and crying publicly on Yom Kippur, and it was really a sight. And if not for this other rabbi who laughed, I would have taken it seriously. But then he laughed, so I didn't take it as seriously. But what happened was, this rabbi would get up there and again publicly be very not trying to make a scene, but he did a little bit make a scene. And this rabbi who was noting it, he said, "I always wondered what this great rabbi was crying about." And so the truth is, the sins of a great rabbi and a great spiritual leader, we hope and we believe, likely are not the same as the sins of a regular, you know, earthly person, let's say. But at the end of the day, great rabbis and great spiritual leaders don't list their sins because it's just not appropriate. The sins that they commit, which everyone is human and everyone has their own yetzer hara, their own evil inclination that guides them to have illicit thoughts and illicit actions, okay, we don't need to publicize it. And in fact, the Chazal even talk about this fact, that just because you have a sin doesn't mean everyone needs to know about it. If you have a sin that you committed against someone else, that you hurt someone else, and that you need to ask for mechila, for forgiveness for them, okay, so then again, it doesn't need to be a public thing, but you can talk to that person and have that one-on-one conversation. But if you do something really bad and it was only a mitzvah between you and God, or a sin between you and God, how dare you publicize it to everyone? It just makes the entirety of the religion and of the service of God feel more polluted. Oh, that guy did that? Okay, I guess I could do that too. And so never do we really believe in this idea of publicly just putting out there all the sins that we've committed. And that, again, could also be questionable if Shlomo HaMelech really wanted everyone to be out there with this knowledge. I will say one additional fact, and that is Chazal talk about the life of Shlomo HaMelech. And King Solomon had probably one of the most fascinating lives in the entirety of, and when you compare him with other figures in Tanakh and in Jewish history, particularly, and again, literally, not literally, it's difficult to judge, but Chazal talk about the fact that Shlomo HaMelech had this ability to connect not just with the world as we see it, but also the underworld and the demons. And there is a long story that Chazal talk about, that Shlomo HaMelech had this relationship with Ashmedai, who was one of these really bad demons of the underworld. And the Chazal even talk about the fact that this Ashmedai took over Shlomo HaMelech. He took over the form of King Solomon, and he was the king of Jerusalem for many years. And so there are those, and again, this is, I'll say it, but it's not really an acceptable belief as far as Jewish tradition. Sorry?
That's in the Shir HaShirim.
What is?
When he's still there, and he was walking on the street of Jerusalem, because the demon is all his kingdom.
So nowhere in any text of Tanakh, Shir HaShirim included, is it shown that he had this relationship with this demon. It's only Chazal, only the rabbis who talk about it in the Gemara that that we learn this, but nowhere in the text itself.
I thought it was in the Shir HaShirim, in the part that he was walking on the street to...
David, is she working with you? She says I'm wrong too. All right, Elishevi, if you find it, you show me, okay? I'm not aware, but I could be... David Goldstein says I could be wrong. So I took it... so it really, if you find it, let me know. But to my knowledge, no. And so again, so there are those who might want to pontificate and say, how can we say for sure who wrote the various texts of the life of King Solomon? Again, not an acceptable belief according to Orthodox Judaism, but interesting to think about as a throwing it out there possibility. Okay, with all that, with just a few minutes left, what I want to do is talk about a few different possibilities and reasons why it is that we read it on the holiday of Sukkot. And it's interesting because there is not necessarily a singular perspective over here, which always means what? If there's not a single answer to something, then what does that tell us? There were Jews, right? But right, that no one really knows. A lot of people kind of just guessing and making assumptions. It's an ancient tradition that we do read Koheles on the holiday of Sukkot, but there really are a number of different answers out there. One potential answer is, as I think Elisheva, we'll just do this outside. One potential answer is that Elisheva shared before, and that is this notion of hakel. There is this mitzvah that the Jewish king is supposed to gather everyone together, and so there are those who explain is that that's what he was doing in the context of the book of Koheles. He was gathering everyone together. That's why he was named Koheles, and that's what he was doing, and so that's why it gets called Koheles. And when does Hakel take place? It takes place on the holiday of Sukkot, and so therefore it's perfect that this should be read on the holiday of Sukkot. There are other reasons that are given. Another is the fact that one of the psukim talks about something, I can't remember off the top of my head, but something about this idea of 7 days or 8 days or something like that, and there are those who say, oh, this specific verse seems to be talking about a 7-day holiday and an 8th-day holiday, and so therefore that sounds like Sukkot and Shemini Atzeres. So we read the book of Koheles on the holiday of Sukkot for that reason. Others like to explain exactly what Dr. Goldstein said earlier, and that is that we have just finished the most existentially trying part of the Jewish calendar year. We had Rosh Hashanah, we had Yom Kippur. All of the big questions in our lives were asked. And hopefully we have some solace and have some understanding of what to do now the rest of the year and a path to move forward. And so it makes sense that we would read the book that talks all about the meaning of life, which for us should be clear, right? We know exactly what the meaning of life is. And perhaps to sort of dovetail on that same note, maybe that's why we read Koheles this time of year specifically, because if you read this another time of year that's not, you know, in the air or has the aura of tshuva, you might read the words of Koheles and say, huh, you know, I'd like to try that too. You know, that middle chapter, that sounds very good. But if you come right after the high holidays and you're sort of beginning to start off the year once again, so you read the book of Koheles and you say, oh man, yeah, that guy did all those things. That stuff is behind me. I just atoned for that yesterday. And now I'm focusing on the last pasuk, the last verse, telling me to serve God. And that I know very well. And so there are additional other reasons why we might be reading the book of Koheles during this time period. But those are three of what I would say are the primary explanations that are given. And it's interesting to note, as we move forward, God willing, over the next few weeks, to try and grapple with and understand every single note that we made over the last 50 minutes or so, and namely to try to think about the fact that when we go through every single chapter and every single pasuk, Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, one of the greatest leaders of the Jewish people, he was the author of this, which again, that's how we assume and understand. He was the one who said these things, and he was maybe even the one who helped write these things, and that is complex, and we'll have to analyze that a little bit. Number two, we'll have to grapple with the fact of, we read it on the holiday of Sukkot. Did Shlomo HaMelech intend it to be read on the holiday of Sukkot, or right? So we'll have to try to understand that. And then lastly, we'll have to grapple with what we began with, and with this we'll conclude, this notion of the I, this constant self-obsession that the author of Kohelet says that Shlomo HaMelech has about himself. What is the takeaway of that? Is there a deeper message, or is it that we're supposed to see this was a self-obsessed person, and that's, as Rabbi Sacks said, that's why he was so unhappy? Or perhaps there's another message that we'll begin to break into, but that should hopefully conclude the shiur with that, that these are some of the major questions that we have before we even break into the book of Kohelet, and God willing, next week, we'll actually start learning a little bit inside, and I guess if you can, we'll probably bring it up on the screen, but if you can, bring your own book of Kohelet, that would be great, and wish everyone a beautiful evening. Thanks for joining.